alone worry about it for almost 16 years of my life. Worrying about money makes you old. Eventually, she gives a wispy sigh. Well, I want to help. I'll try to come up with some ideas, too. Without your dad knowing. Ellie gives me a smile, like she understands that this is about protecting him. And somehow, my dad too. Without my dad knowing. The skinny dippers are back near the bonfire now, pooling around the shore to get dressed. It's a miracle no one stole the clothes. A voluptuous blonde is turning cartwheels in her bra and panties. A thong, no less. Ah, yes. My girlfriend. Bare-assed in front of everyone I know. I want to jump into the bonfire. So, I say, trying to sound like I think it's funny. That's Vivi. Ellie laughs, and I expect her to give me a look of judgment. I feel like I deserve to be judged, but her kind smile remains. Good for her. I'd totally do it. Skinny dipping, I mean. But Diego's stupid friends are here, and they'd probably tattle to my parents. Maybe next year. I smile over at her. Maybe I'm being judgmental. Vivi's having fun. That's all. I think she's had more than a few beers. Sorry she was kind of weird to you earlier. Ellie waves my apology off. She looks all around us for a moment. At the people laughing. At our town.
Do you remember last summer? Us talking about leaving Verona Cove?
Yeah. We were closing up, wiping down tables at the restaurant. She's watching my face in the firelight.
Do you still feel that way? Even on nights like tonight?
I nod. We'd both admitted that we want to leave after high school. That we love our families. We love the people and knowing a place so well. But, as Ellie puts it, sometimes you can't breathe. And I feel guiltier than ever. You know?
How could I want to leave the place? My dad... He'd want you to.
She gathers her skirt to stand up.
We can always come back. See what's out there?
It'll still be here.
Well, I'll see you soon.
She's probably smart to leave before Vivi gets back. When I look around, I find Vivi posing for a picture with someone I don't even recognize, wearing just her bra and underwear. That's it. I haven't seen how much she's had to drink, but clearly too much. I walk up, unamused, but she's bubbling over as she buttons her shorts.
Hey! Ah, that was such a rush. You seriously missed out, Jonah. I mean it.
Her charming ball of energy routine isn't going to work on me. I'm embarrassed and mad. Great. We need to go home now.
No! What? No way! It's just getting fun!
I drop my voice to a whisper. Viv, you're drunk, and I think we need to leave before any more people have almost nude pics of you.
Excuse me!
She snaps her fingers at her sides, over and over, and I keep expecting to smell the booze on her. Her eyes look bleary, like she's struggling to focus.
I'm not a child, and it's my body, and I can run wild if I damn well please, and screw you for judging me. What do you care what I do anyway? You're so busy flirting with Ellie.
This stuns me. I stand mute. That's not what it's like at all. She makes a disgusted face.
Ellie, it sounds like a little kid's name.
Short for Eliana. Shit. I think, seeing Vivi's eyes narrow. Should have kept my mouth shut.
Well, isn't that special? What's her middle name? What's her favorite color? Do you just know everything about her?
Now I'm just mad and swinging back.
Carmen, Green, and you're being ridiculous. Come on, we're leaving.
This was the wrong thing to say, too. I never say the right thing.
No, no, no!
Her voice is so loud that my face goes hot.
I can't even look at you right now with the way you're behaving. Jonah, truly, it's not okay.
Feelings mutual, Viv, I whisper. But I'm not leaving you here by yourself, wasted.
Damn right you're not. I'm leaving you here, non-wasted.
Before I can get even a single word in,
she takes off skipping toward the hill that leads back up toward town.
I don't bother to call out to her. I don't bother to follow. So much for putting on a good show at the bonfire. People have totally noticed our conversation, staring as Vivi takes off. I stalk toward home, my sister's words echoing in my head. I just want to survive this endless fucking awful ear. I'm not sure how long I've been asleep when I hear the latch on my bedroom door. "It's okay, Leah," I murmur. "It was just a dream. You're okay. Everyone's okay." But she doesn't say anything. I hear the door lock, and I sit up, suddenly wide awake. Vivi wafts in with the scent of campfire smoke and beer. She crawls up the bed, her body warm and suddenly next to mine. "Are you mad at me?" "How did you get in here?" My room is on the top floor, just low-beam attic space with my bed and desk. She couldn't have gotten up using the roof. She sighs as if my common sense is exhausting to her. "Silas let me in. He fell asleep on the couch. Are you mad?" "I don't know. I really don't. And right now all I can think is that my mom or younger siblings will catch us in here. I'm confused."
"Okay? About what? I thought we had a good thing here, and then you strip down in front of every guy I go to school with, and you're mad that I don't like it, but then you freak out when I talk to another girl?"
"Sound needier, Jonah, seriously. But I won't take it back. It's true."
"Jonah,"
her whisper shivers in the air between us,
"I'm trying to live to the fullest. I'm trying to feel everything. I prioritize experiences over anything or anyone. And maybe that isn't easy for you to accept, and I'm sorry, but that's who I am."
A non-apology. I didn't expect one anyway. Not her style. Vivi shifts across my twin bed, straddling herself over me. She looks right into my face.
"Jonah, I think you're a wonderful person with a soul that reaches so far beyond your years. And maybe the humane thing to do would be to leave you alone because I'm not ever going to be some kind of dutiful, well-behaved girlfriend. But I don't want to leave you alone."
It is very, very hard to think with her on top of me.
"Dutiful? I don't even want whatever you just said." "Okay, then how about you just let me be me and I'll let you be you. We'll feel everything we feel and not apologize for it. If we get mad at each other, we'll have it out, and then we'll make up."
That's just it. Vivi does allow me to be myself. She never shoves me out of my sad moods. She never tries to talk me out of my frustrations. Vivi is all action. "Let's go to the beach, let's write a play, let's build an ice cream sundae bar at the house and then play Candyland while watching Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory with the littles." She leans close to me, offering her lips for the taking.
"Jonah, make up with me."
I pull her in and kiss her, with teeth against her lips because I'm still mad, and because we fit together. And even when we don't, clashing only makes more sparks. In the movies, the music always starts up right about now, slowly louder with a solid beat. When a girl sneaks into your bedroom, it's surprisingly quiet. But everything sounds loud for fear of being caught. Mouths against skin. Pieces of clothing dropping to the floor. Heavy breathing and the drone of the thought.
This is happening. This is happening.
And eventually the sound of your own voice asking, "Are you sure?" What you get in return is, apparently, a muffled giggle in the words,
"Yes, God, you're so cute, it kills me."
You try not to think that it seems so casual for her. You try to convince yourself you feel the same, but you don't. Your feelings fill the room like an angry fire. Your feelings for her could blow the glass out of the windows. When I wake up in the morning, she's gone. The sheets are pulled back from her side, and there's a black Sharpie on the floor that I guess fell off my desk when I was fumbling around for a condom. It takes me until I'm getting dressed to notice. On the wood of my headboard, where it meets the mattress, tiny letters, "Vivi was here." As if I'd forget.
Chapter 13. Vivi. For 2 weeks after the bonfire, everything I paint is midnight and gold and maroon and ballet slipper pink, passionate and deep and metallic. I rip up an old dress, black with thin gold stripes, and sew it into a crop top and high-waisted shorts that look perfect on me. My mom decides I can keep the Vespa if I always wear my helmet and repay my account with money I make from my job. At the pottery shop, I glaze broken pieces from the kiln and make them into a mosaic for Whitney. I teach the littles how to swing dance using online videos and my own pizzazz. We have a picnic in the backyard. We decorate cookies in the shape of suns and palm trees and beach balls. We build a sand fortress at the beach. I kiss Jonah Daniels 4,000 times, every second his family isn't looking. We bicker about everything on planet Earth and beyond. I think jellyfish are so beautiful, translucent and dancing underwater in fringed skirts. Jonah wishes they would drop dead in the sea. I like boxed mac and cheese with that gooey yellow cheese sauce. Jonah's face turns pink with frustration, and he makes me homemade mac and cheese to prove his point. And of course I believe in extraterrestrial life. I bet they've already been here, I say. But Jonah shakes his head. I drag him out to the beach late at night to see the sunrise. But we get all tangled up. Tongues and skin and hands and gasps and yes, and by the time I'm fully aware of the world again, it's gone from dark to glowing. I don't care that I missed the sunrise, because I'd much rather make one of my own. My birthday dress arrives, and I hang it on a nail in the wall because it is art. I order white butterfly wings online, and it takes me 3 tries to mix the perfect blue paint. On the day of my birthday, I open my eyes to the sound of my mom's off-key voice singing me happy birthday. I wasn't sleeping, but I was lying in bed dreaming. She's holding an oversized strawberry cupcake in her hands, and the tall gold candle flickers as she walks toward me. "Make a wish, chickadee," she says. I sit up and blow it out and make my wish, and we relax against my pillows, devouring the cupcake and ignoring the crumbs that drop to my duvet cover. I open her glittery card, and a gift card for my favorite online art store falls out. There's also a scrap of paper which reads, "IOU, save this ticket." It's not quite ready yet. I pick it up on Saturday. Her smile is very self-satisfied, so I'm intrigued. Oh, and I almost forgot. This came for you, too. She hands me a white envelope with my name and handwriting I know well enough to imitate. Return address. Ruby Oshiro, Seattle, Washington. And I stop breathing. She called me last week for our new address, my mom is saying. I don't want to open this in front of her because I have no idea what it might say. I was so glad to hear you guys are back to normal. She said you hadn't been in touch with her at all. I told my mom that Ruby and Amala wouldn't speak to me after what happened in March, which would have been true, I'm sure of it, so I didn't give them a chance. Amala didn't try, but Ruby called and texted and knocked on my front door. I never opened it. "Chickie," my mom asks quietly, "Ruby knows, right? About the bipolar disorder?" My silence serves as an obvious answer, especially since I can't meet her eyes. I feel my mom draw away from me. "Vivian, Ruby is your oldest friend. How could you not tell her? After everything that happened?" "I don't have to tell her everything, and I don't have to tell you everything either." Before she can protest, I cut her off. "You won't even tell me who my dad is, so I don't think I need to provide you with the status of all my relationships." "That," she says darkly, "is entirely different. I am protecting you until you are old enough to deal with certain realities."
"Maybe I'm protecting you."
If she only knew. I mean, she knows a little. The tattoo, the outrageous money I spent on clothes and presents. She doesn't know exactly what happened at Ruby's 16th birthday party last March. What I did. "I know you've been asking to stay in Verona Cove, and I've told you that I'll consider it. And I will, if it is genuinely what is best for you." Her eyes narrow, the smugness of someone who is revealing the ace up her sleeve. "I will not consider staying here if you're just hiding." She says this as if the two things are mutually exclusive.
"It's nothing to be ashamed of, Viv. You have an illness."
"Stop! You are obsessed with this!" Tears fill my eyes, and I feel my hands clench, bending the card. It's my birthday! God, Mom! I'm sorry, she whispers. I shouldn't have... I just worry and... Well, come downstairs if you want more breakfast. I got everything for German pancakes. I open the envelope after she's gone and find a handmade card. Of course. I've admired Ruby's cut paper art for years, the intricacy and detail. She can slice a National Geographic photo of an oil spill into a tiny leather jacket, a cotton blossom pattern into puffy clouds, trim strips of chevron and polka dots for a hot air balloon. This card is more sentimental than Ruby's usual work, and the paper girl staring out her bedroom window is Ruby herself, her jet bangs feathered on her forehead, her trademark fuchsia lips and black leggings, floral for her comforter, birch for the window frame, stripes for her little boat neck shirt. But her heart is pasted on the outside of her chest, as hot pink as her mouth. Beyond the window, instead of blue sky, is a square of paper from a map. A tiny red heart at the top of California. My tears make it hard to see the inside. Oh, Rue. Break my actual beating heart, why don't you? In her calligraphy script. Happy birthday, Viv. Miss you. Nothing more, nothing less. No demands for an explanation. No accusations. No hint about if Amala hates me as viciously as I'm sure she must. Fingers pinching the top of the card, I'm tempted to rip it to scrap paper. But Ruby would never create something to make me feel guilty, only to feel loved. Still, the guilt pushes through my veins, roiling and acidic and spreading. Spreading. After last March, I knew I didn't deserve friends like that. I didn't deserve friends at all, when all I did was betray them. But now I allow myself one text, line after line of her attempts to contact me, most of which I never even read, and I finally type three words that I've felt for months and months. Miss you too. I push these thoughts away at the Daniels residence, because I'm busy turning a little girl into a plume-tailed bird. Spin, I tell Leah. She obeys. Yep, you are the most magnificent child peacock there ever was. Jonah isn't home because he's already at the restaurant, working on my party dinner. But Silas, Becca, and Isaac all agree on Leah's magnificence, from her shiny blue leotard to the fanned-out feather tail, to the way I rimmed her eyes in white and black face paint. She dances around, as giddy about my party as I am. The other three refuse to tell me their costume selections, on Jonah's order. All right, I announce. I have to go home to get dressed. Originally, I considered dressing up as a dolphin as an homage to my soul's former vessel. But you'd be surprised how difficult it is, even for someone as talented as me, to create a dolphin costume for an almost 17-year-old human girl. Besides, I want wings, because, well, don't we all? Sometimes I bend my arms behind my back and feel the protruding shoulder blades, technically the scapula, but they feel like broken-off wings. Everyone thinks we evolved from apes, but I'm not totally convinced that we didn't once have wings. At least some of us. For one night, I want my wings back. But not the wings of a mighty bird, beating powerfully enough to make noise against the air. I want to drift dreamily in the breeze, to let the wind direct me. I know. Butterflies are used in bad metaphors about metamorphosis, about bursting forth from a cocoon, born again and in flight. But I'm not dressing as a butterfly to prove that my caterpillar days are behind me. No. No symbolism. It is enough to choose things for their beauty. My wings are wide and diaphanous, nylon stretched over thin, arced wire. I painted the inner parts with the eye-aching, perfect blue of a sunny day. But the edges are black, as if dipped in ink. Between the two colors, I painted little rivers of veins like a leaf surface. The true showpiece is not my meticulous wings, but my vintage dress. I paid a small fortune for it, but this beauty is worth every nickel. It's from the 1930s, a tight-fitting flapper dress slicked in glossy black beads. The hem ends in a fringe right about my knee, and the straps split into these fabulous V-shapes across my bare shoulders. Okay, fine. I'll admit I'm wearing a very padded strapless bra, but this dress deserves truly divine cleavage, you know? I'm wearing black satin point shoes, which don't feel wonderful on my toes, but they look wonderful to my eyes and make me feel graceful. So there. I glued thick black lashes to my eyelids and lined them in a shimmering navy color. For once I forgo the red lipstick for a cherry blossom pink, because that's how the makeup spirit moves me. Jonah wanted to pick me up, but I begged him not to. If there's ever a night to zoom through town on my Vespa, it's the night when I'm the most glamorous butterfly to ever waft the earth. I drive slower than usual, so that my wings are pushed straight back, and I feel somewhere between a superhero and a pageant queen waving in a parade. My true self. Jonah's waiting outside Tony's, done to the nines in a black tuxedo, complete with tails and a white bow tie and vest and, oh my stars, my hands go shaky as I park the Vespa.
"Happy birthday,"
he says, before I even dismount. "Where's your helmet?" Oh, please, like I was going to mat down the hair I spent 45 minutes on just for a 2-minute ride at 25 miles an hour. As usual, Jonah outparents every actual parent in the world. "So, what are you supposed to be? Just, like, fancy man?" He smiles and stiffens his arms at his sides, toddling back and forth on each foot.
"Penguin."
When I don't react at first, for sheer gobsmacked delight, his shyly prideful smile fades to doubt.
"No, I thought it would go with your dress, and..."
I stop him with a kiss, because it's perfect. And also because I've never kissed a boy in a tuxedo, and you know what? I could get used to it. I throw my arms around his neck and pull myself up to him a little, delighted by how anachronistic it feels. Full on making out in public while wearing vintage formal wear. Heavens to Betsy, forget this party. I'll take him home and have a party of our own. But he straightens up, collecting himself again. And I'm surprised to find my pink lipstick has left no mark on his mouth. I'll have to try harder next time.
"You look..."
he begins, swallowing up my dress with his eyes.
"Well, you know how you look."
"I do." With a curtsy, I accept his speechlessness as the compliment that it is. He leads me to the side walkway, where there are lights and laughter twinkling from the patio. I'm holding my breath in excitement, and all the extra air in my lungs makes my heartbeat more pronounced, thuddier against my ribcage. Jonah opens the gate entrance, and my guests cry, "Happy birthday!" so loudly that it's like walking into a wall of sound. And the tears spring to my eyes, blurring everything into blobs of color and glowing light. There are two picnic tables pushed together, lengthwise, with big pillar candles and lanterns down the center. The leaves are deep jade, crawling up the wooden trellises. And there are white fairy lights everywhere, and Chinese lanterns that glow like planets suspended in the galaxy. And benches are filled with my mom, and these beautiful people who barely know me, and will not only show up, but show up in costume. I can barely make them out, but I see the feathered pink flamingo costume that my mom was perfecting for herself this morning. There should be a word for this feeling. Spectacularity, or burstsomeness. It's too much to damn inside my body, and I cover my face just moments before the tears spurt out. I don't even want to try to stop myself from feeling everything, from reacting the way I really feel, because I am only turning 17 once, and I am honestly trying to live this life while I can. The emotion swells around me, into this huge, humid feeling that I must be doing something right.
"Viv,"
Jonah whispers,
"please tell me that's a happy cry."
I slide my hands down an inch, so my fingertips rest right below my eyes. Jonah's eyebrows are turned down, those dark eyes concerned and desperate to read me.
"This is literally the most wonderful thing that anyone has ever done for me,"
I choke out. Then I laugh, partially so everyone knows I'm okay, and partially because I feel half hysterical with love and gratitude.
"This is already the best night of my life, and it just started."
Jonah guides me to my seat at the head of the table, and I clear the tears from my eyes to take in all my guests. Isaac is an owl, with a yellow construction paper triangle taped to the noseband of his glasses. The bottom of Silas's nose is painted black, and he's wearing a sweatband around his head that is mounted with two long black socks, droopy puppy ears covering his own. Becca is in what looks to be a store-bought bumblebee costume, perhaps a relic of Halloween past. Whitney's dress is covered in glued-on white cotton balls, and little black sheep's ears stick up from her curly wild hair. My mom, the flamingo, Leah, my peacock, my tiniest friend, and between them, Officer Hayashi. "What animal are you?" I tease, since he's just in a nondescript blue sweater. But it looks like he's combed his white hair, and I could die from the sweetness of him sitting between Leah and my mom.
"Grumpy old bear," he says,
and I laugh and laugh, interrupted only by someone touching my arm gently. "Sorry I'm late," Naomi says, although her tone is unremorseful. She didn't wear a costume either, but I like her dress, which is brown with white polka dots. After she takes her place by Silas, she reaches into her purse and pulls out a headband with two pert little ears on either side. She's a dear. Of course she is, with her long limbs and speckled dress. The tears want to start again, but the food is coming, and I choose to focus on that. Ellie emerges in a white shirt and black vest, our waitress for the evening. And I'm having such a nice time that I don't even care that her skin glows like amber in the candlelight. She serves us the food Jonah has made, all family style in big bowls or on platters, beautiful green salad glossed in champagne vinaigrette, and coconut tilapia, breaded and fried and slathered in some sort of spicy pineapple relish that my mind can't explain, but my taste buds can relish, savor, memorize. My eyes well up as I open my presents. A book from Isaac, and silvery pink nail polish from Becca, and a hand-drawn portrait of me from Leah, and a mug Whitney made herself.
"Here, give that to her."
Hayashi has Leah pass me a little plant still in its plastic container from the nursery.
"It's a..."
I know. A Japanese maple seedling. If I can't go to Japan yet, he gave a little piece to me. And it's almost impossible for me to swallow.
"Well, I know how you like trees," he says gruffly. "Maybe if you grow your own, you won't be tempted to deface arboreal public property."
"What?" my mom asks, and my jaw drops open. "He's seen my tree in Irving Park?"
"Oh, nothing,"
Hayashi tells my mom.
"Silly joke."
My eyes are still flooded when Jonah brings the cake out. It's black cherry and chocolate, two layers, with sparklers instead of candles. I watch them sizzle, and I wish for nothing. How could I dare? How could I dare when I have all this? Jonah and I leave only after I have hugged everyone in attendance at least twice, even Naomi, who stiffens at my embrace. And then we take off on my Vespa with Jonah driving, even though he's technically not supposed to. He makes us stop at home to pick up the helmets. One more surprise, or so he says, and I close my eyes with my arms latched around his waist, wings thrashing violently at my back. He's driving farther and farther toward the coastline, not stopping until we're in front of a building that looks like a small-town church with a steeple. But no, it's a lighthouse. The light isn't on, but I can see its shape. A tower with a circular walkway and black iron handrails. A glass planet trapped inside a birdcage.
"Come on,"
Jonah says, pulling me by the hand after we climb off the Vespa. "Are we going in? Can you get us in?"
"Yeah, my dad knows the caretaker. Knew him, I mean."
From his pocket, Jonah produces a key on an old lanyard and opens the front door. The piping along the edges of the house reminds me of gingerbread, like you could shingle the roof in licorice and cover the windows with giant peppermints. Inside, the room is dusty and piney and filled with racks of postcards and model ships. Jonah watches me as I survey the trinkets, running my hands along shelf after shelf filled with maritime books.
"My dad's friend started volunteering at the gift shop when he retired. The lighthouse obviously doesn't get used for boats anymore, but the Verona Cove Historical Society restored the building and light a few years before I was born. There are actually lots of lighthouse tourists.
Enchanting. My voice is a whisper as to not disturb the delightfully spooky atmosphere. Can we go up?
Where do you think I'm taking you? The basement?
He smiles, lopsided and pleased with himself.
You sure you don't want my jacket?
I fluff my hair. Oh, Jonah, as if I'd cover up this dress. He leads me up a spiral staircase, and I can tell even from the back of his head that he's smiling, because he knows I'm totally taken with this. All of it. My heart beats 4 times as fast as our footsteps up the stairs, the thump, at the quietness and anticipation. The wind whips straight into my ears as we enter the lighthouse's deck, but the air off the Pacific is warm, and I gasp at the view. For a moment, I nearly lose my depth perception, trying to reconcile the new heights with the stars and the sea. And I understand why the guardrail rises all the way to my waist.
Wow.
The word is a hush against the night. For all the joy that tonight's dinner gave me, all the fullness and humanity and communing, this is something else entirely. I'm at the bow of the terrestrial Earth, steering straight toward the cosmos. I'm watched over by the dove-gray moon, his gentle head bowed, and I have to wonder if this is Yugen. Profound beauty in the natural world. So subtle that it calls up a feeling of wonder without naming it. The word has no English counterpart, and neither does this feeling. So I stand witness to the universe, without any thought but enjoying my front row seat.
Close your eyes,
Jonah says, and I do it immediately. I close my eyes, and the first thing I hear is music coming from what sounds like a crackly old radio. And then I feel light flash against my eyelids, a sun exploding right in front of me. I open my eyes toward the sea to find that I'm backlit. The light on and ablaze, too bright to look back at. Jonah appears beside me, his hands on the rail.
The town paid an insane amount of money for it to be a working lighthouse. They only turn it on for special occasions.
They let you light it for my birthday? I can't believe this. I honestly cannot. How silly I was at the beginning of the summer, believing Jonah needed me to make him happy. His mouth slips into a smile.
Let's just say I'd rather beg forgiveness than ask permission.
We stand together for what feels like a long time, the radio playing melodies over the white noise of sloshing waves.
My dad used to take me here,
Jonah says finally.
He's the one who brought that radio up here, to listen to baseball games. I was obsessed with baseball and boats as a kid. We don't really have boats in Verona Cove, but we pretended.
Of course you love boats. I adjust the straps of my wings. You used to be a sea captain. He smiles at me, shaking his head in that oh, Viv kind of way, that lets me know he's so terribly fond of me and the things he perceives as eccentricities.
I haven't been back here since.
This feels like an admission, like he's confessing to a weakness or flaw.
But I wanted you to see it.
I know what he means to say. I wanted you to see me. And I do see him. Illuminated with his downturned eyes and the mouth that must be pried into a smile. That gorgeous hair dancing in this wind. I also know he can't talk about his dad so easily. Like each word tries to float up his windpipe. But they get stuck to the back of his throat. For once, I keep my damn mouth shut, because I want to leave room for him.
Have you ever heard that saying, ships are safe in harbor, but that's not what ships are for?
I nod, although I'm not sure where or how I've heard. Maybe it's one of those phrases that somehow exists in the collective subconscious of all people, and especially those of us who are drawn to the sea, who hear a siren call to the water.
My dad had that quote engraved on the underside of this watch that his dad gave him. He said it's the reason he spent all his money opening the restaurant. Why he married my mom and had us kids so young.
He sighs, looking down at the ocean below us.
He said, the measure of the man is in those decisions. Do you keep yourself and your family safe in harbor always? Or do you move forward and brave the storms?
At this, I reach for his arm, placing my hand over the sleeve of his tuxedo jacket. He sounds like such a good dad.
He was.
Jonah's stare stays out over the water.
I keep wondering if it'll ever hurt less. This hole in our lives.
Oh, I imagine it'll hurt less eventually. I think there will always be a hole, though. But lace is one of the most beautiful fabrics, you know. All those holes and gaps, but it's still complete somehow. Still lovely. This makes him smile, at least.
I wouldn't have thought about it like that. Sorry, I'm being a downer. I was lucky to have him for as long as I did. I know that.
This makes me tilt my head away from him, frowning as I consider what he means. Jonah, you don't have to justify missing him just because I don't have a dad. They're totally different things. He locks eyes with me, daring a question.
Do you ever miss your dad?
Is it possible to miss someone you never met? I ask.
But I do.
Miss my dad, I mean. Or at least, I wonder what I might be missing by not knowing him. Every once in a while, when my mood starts to whirlpool, I feel angry at him, or my mom, or I feel sorry for myself. Yes, I suppose it is possible. Because I miss your dad sometimes, even though I never met him. I feel like I know him a little. Like if I collect fragments of the six of you and tape them together. There he is. A mosaic of your pieces. This gets a smile, if a sad one.
Do you know anything about your dad?
He was a musician, I think. I figured some of it out, even though my mom refuses to talk about him. I badgered her so much when I was little, just for one detail, that she finally told me she met him when she was at a concert. In my mind, I can see my mom, only 19, and this blur of a man I've never seen or met. I imagine him with longish hair and a stubbly rock star beard, maybe tight pants and tattoos. I don't really blame him for not being around, you know. He's a creative soul, a free-spirited musician, and I think that's partially where I get my wild streak from. That's just who he is, wherever he is. And I like that I come from artistic stock anyway. I cock my hip, posing with one hand in my hair. I actually feel bad for the guy. He doesn't even know what he's missing. Jonah looks at me so admiringly, and my heart bounces like a pinball from my stomach to my throat to either side of my ribcage. I know I am something special. I know that I am, because I am trying to be, and it is nice to be seen, the way I see him. I face the ocean, and he wraps both of his arms around me, chin on my shoulder. I have this feeling that if we fell forward into the water, hanging on to Jonah would buoy me, drag me back up to the surface. Some of the guys I've been with, they've tried to pin me down. They wanted to box me into the details, the wheres and whens and hows of our togetherness. And it always pinched my nerves that they needed to map out a plan for feelings. Other guys, they seemed totally content to let me prance in and out of their lives, relieved that they didn't have to agree to future plans. No concert tickets for a show later that summer. No prom tickets months in advance. Jonah doesn't do either thing. We are together for now, above the choppy black water and the flicking white waves, and it is enough. And the next horrible thought is how badly I want to tell Ruby and Amala about him. I try to push away the idea of them. In my mind, we're always in Amala's bedroom, dyeing the tips of Ruby's hair some fantastic color and howling over stupid jokes. We went to art museums and the most hip coffee shops and record stores and concerts. Why do I go back to the simplest moments in pajamas?
Viv?
Jonah asks.
You okay?
Yeah, I say, almost hesitating. Did you have a group of friends before your dad? He nods against my shoulder.
Good guys. They're not gone or anything. I'm just really busy. And, you know, they don't know how to talk to me about everything.
Before I can say anything, he jumps back in.
You never talk about friends back home. You must have 1,000 based on 100 you have in Verona Cove.
I lift one shoulder, glad he can't see my face. We had a bit of a falling out before I left. Water under the bridge. I'm here now. So why do I wish I could take a picture of me and Jonah and send it to Ruby and Amala and say this is falling in love with someone good, and it is so good. We stand there pressed together for a while, until it is no longer my birthday. I think about boats, how they're powerful but so delicate compared to the fickle sea. I think about lighthouses, about safe mooring, and how easy it is to crash. I think about love and what I deserve, and how I'm trying to accept everything the universe is giving me. Then the radio changes to something upbeat and folksy. Jonah's voice is near my ear. I can hear his smile.
I like this song.
At first, we stay standing together. But then the chorus plays, and it's free and alive. So the serious-eyed boy in the penguin suit takes the butterfly-winged girl by the hands and spins her. We sway our hips and stamp our feet like the drunken revelry of turning sour grapes into wine. Our bodies block the beam from the lighthouse as we wave our arms. And even though we can't see it, we're casting shadows onto the sky. This is where I am. Somewhere between the night's total darkness and the light's utter brilliance. And I grin as I dance, and the night wind kicks up Jonah's hair. The glow of my birthday candles and the fairy lights would have been more than enough. But Jonah Daniels, he lit up my whole world. Even the constellations can see us now. We are 17 and shattered and still dancing. We have messy, throbbing hearts, and we are stronger than anyone could ever know.
Chapter 14. Jonah. I woke up to the sound of rain. In my exhausted state, I thought the sound was the roof caving in or my window AC unit dying of emphysema. Verona Cove doesn't get rain in the summer. It just doesn't. Sure enough, the sky beyond my third-story window is a mechanical gray. It's not a summer shower. My clock reads 10 a.m., which is not possible. I pass Leah's room on my way to the kitchen. She's still curled in a ball like a sleepy kitten. I never realized it's the sunshine that wakes her up so early every morning. Downstairs, Becca and Isaac are playing a board game I haven't seen in years. They're quiet, not fighting. Today is confusing. I shower and make us egg sandwiches for breakfast instead of oatmeal because, hey, the world is backward anyway. It's raining. My siblings are mellow, and we're eating high cholesterol food. Leah makes a face at her egg sandwich after one bite, so I bring it up to my mom. She's sitting on her bed with a pile of papers fanned out around her, but she's dressed in something other than pajamas, and her hair looks different. Shiny. Brushed? Hey, pal, she says, looking up. Her face is alert. It's hard to explain why the change is so immediately noticeable. When someone is so sad for so long, they lack the energy to move even the tiniest facial muscle. Like they're too sad to even fully lift their eyelids. This morning there's a twitch of movement in my mom's cheeks. Her forehead isn't drooping. Hey, I brought you a breakfast sandwich. It's slightly used by Leah, but still warm. Thanks. A real smile. Seriously, whose life did I wake up to? I squint at the papers around her. I can't resist asking, what are you doing? She tucks a wisp of hair behind her ear. Well, Naomi has been taking care of a lot of household stuff for me. All my muscles cramp. Money talk makes me feel sweatier than a marathon runner. She's been doing a wonderful job, but she needed some help with it this month, so I'm rebalancing to make sure we're all set. Maybe she senses my hypertension. Which we are. Do you know why I majored in accounting? She asks, scribbling something down on the pad of paper in her hands. I do know this, actually. It's easy to forget how well I know my mom. Her grief seems like a disguise, but underneath it, I know her. Because you love math. I really do, she agrees. And I love math because there's always a right answer. It's not interpretive, it's not subjective. There's a correct destination, even if you have to hack through confusing parts to get there. That's not always true in life. I'm glad she's staring down at her numbers and figures. She doesn't see my jaw drop just enough to part my lips. My mom is seemingly functional and even, God, musing about life. I feel insane for reading into this. It's a mirage, a like when she tried to go to the grocery store. It looked like a good sign. It ended in public sobbing.
You're right, I say dumbly.
Well, let me know if you need anything.
I'm still shaking my head, stupefied, when my phone beeps. I expect Vivi. Come to think of it, I'm surprised she hasn't shown up yet. At our front door, wearing a raincoat and boots and imploring us to dance outside with her. I assume she picked up a shift at the pottery shop. Still, it's a rare morning that I don't wake up to a series of dirty and imaginative text messages. She doesn't sleep much. But it's Felix. Slammed. Come in. The restaurant is almost never slammed during lunch, especially on summer weekdays. Most vacationers don't even realize we're open for lunch. But the morning beachgoers have to drive by Tony's on their way back into town. They're probably ducking in for lunch and hoping to wait out the storm. Verona Cove's tourist brochure calls the weather here perfect. It's never sticky hot in the summer and almost never freezing in the winter. But today I feel the cold front. I hurry through the rain with an old golf umbrella I found in the hallway closet. By the time I reach Main Street, the backs of my jeans are splattered. The Tony's sandwich board is out on the street. Someone wedged an umbrella handle in the space at the top where the two sides meet. From a distance, it looks like a very short, very squat person huddled under an umbrella. But the open umbrella protects careful chalk writing. I can read the bright white letters even through the rain. Rainy Days Special, hot soups and homemade bread. We've never offered homemade bread, and we only ever have one soup of the day. I pinch the skin on my forearm, hard, because this feels like a dream. One of those weird ones where it's your life but the details are all messed up. Inside, the kitchen is especially steamy, and the smell is overpowering and savory. More than that, fragrant and yeasty and baked. Felix is chopping vegetables like a madman. Gabe is manning a stovetop full of deep soup pots.
Jonah!
Ellie calls.
Hey!
She's at the prep station near the ovens, rubbing the tops of four loaves of bread dough with shiny olive oil. Her dark hair is tied back loosely beneath a too big baseball cap that I recognize as Felix's. She's wearing a floral apron that she must have brought from home.
Hey, you wanna catch me up here?
Her hands move so fast it looks like she has four or six arms, a frantic cartoon character. Yet her voice is controlled, all business.
We're doing six soups, classic tomato, minestrone, chicken noodle, hot and sour, tortilla, and a special Thai coconut that I thought was risky, but my dad nailed it. Customers are obsessed.
We also have four breads to choose from, French bread, cornbread, Asiago, and garlic rosemary. Ellie pauses, taking a breath. Her hands sprinkle loose herbs onto the bread loaves, which she then pats down expertly.
A bowl of soup and your choice of bread is a side for $5, or for $3 extra you get a grilled cheese with your soup. Add more than one type of cheese for 50 cents each. The available cheeses are...
I know them. I created the dairy organizational system in the fridge last year. I can recite the cheese alphabetically or by flavor, mild to sharp. I'll have to put that on my college applications. Jonah Daniels, cheese arranger. I may have quit all my school activities to take care of my siblings, but hey, I can keep a kitchen staff from mixing up provolone with mozzarella slices. Full scholarship material.
Oh, right.
She laughs at herself as she washes flecks of rosemary off her hands.
I'm sales pitching you like you're a customer. We need another person on the floor, so I'm going to take orders if you can handle the bread for me, unless you want to wait tables.
No, cooking good. My mind is already whipped up in the rush of the kitchen. My hands are on autopilot, tying my apron behind my back. The kitchen is best when we're on the brink of chaos. Being understaffed is a total adrenaline rush. It doesn't happen enough. After Ellie explains the bread schedule and leaves, I stand there for a moment. It's a lot to take in. Felix laughs at me as he slides a mound of vegetables from his cutting board to a huge pot.
She's a girl with a plan.
Okay. Game time. I transfer the now perfectly crusted Asiago bread into the warming oven and move to the cornbread batter.
How'd you come up with this?
Another snort of laughter from Felix.
Come on, Manny, you think I came up with this? It was all that kid of mine. She woke up early and smelled the rain like a basset hound. Next thing you know, she's down here with her abuela's bread recipes, talking me into her plan. All right, quick run to Patterson's for more carrots and celery, and what else did we say? Coconut milk, Gabe calls from the stove.
When Felix is out the back door, Jack, one of the prep cooks, looks up from plating the soups with the grilled cheeses.
How old is Ellie?
16. No, Jack.
Yes, Jack, he says. I'm only 18. What, I think I've got a shot? She's a cool girl.
Dude, she would eat you alive.
What?
Ellie takes zero shit. I put the cornbread in the oven, and you are full of it. He and Gabe live to joke around in the kitchen, and I have to admit they're funny. But, as if to prove my point, the kitchen door swings open. Ellie sticks her head in.
Hurry it up, you clowns!
The restaurant stays packed through lunch hour. Bread in the oven, bread out. Season the chicken broth, on and on. My mind numbs in that way I've only ever found in the kitchen. And with Vivi. Despite the frantic pace, I sneak a moment to peer out the kitchen door. It's a swinging door with a plexiglass circle window out to the dining room. When I was little, it made me think of a submarine. There are families at every table, lifting spoonfuls of soup to their mouths, slathering butter on their bread, heads leaning back in loud laughter. The restaurant is busy, but the world feels slow. No one is hurrying because there's nothing to hurry to. They're together. I miss my dad so much that my stomach almost heaves. I have to keep moving. Keep working. By 4 p.m., they've cleared out. And the dinner prep shift has started to overlap with our finely honed routine.
Go on, both of you,
Felix tells Ellie and me.
You worked a good day.
Okay, Ellie replies, leaning over to kiss her dad on the cheek. She turns to me.
Are you walking home? I have something to show you.
Yeah. Okay. I glance back at Felix to see if he looks in the know. He looks amused.
You're a dick,
Jack says, pointing at me. Outside, Ellie's waiting. The rain has stopped. The air still smells like wet dirt and ozone. As we walk out the door, she hands me a folded sheet of paper, which is covered in the blue ink of her neat handwriting.
Some notes. Well, observations, I guess. She points to the first line. I spent some time thinking about trends in my interactions with customers as their waitress, because, you know, they ask me about certain dishes or tell me which ones they're trying to decide between.
I start at the top. Overview. Types of customers. Townie, regulars. Something light and healthy, vacationers. And people who just want the most possible amount of food. My eyes jump to the bottom of the page. Conclusions. It says, like this is a paper for school. Create an official kids menu with a few simple offerings. Expand our salad menu so customers can add grilled chicken or shrimp. Designate meals on the menu that are vegetarian and gluten-free, and also create a few more options that are vegetarian and gluten-free. There are more. Wow. Ellie clears her throat.
After today, I also think we should consider a sandwich and soup combo for the lunch hour.
Yeah, great. My word bank has depleted after the dizzying lunch shift. This is great. And unexpected. I know Ellie said she wanted to help, but I had no idea she cared this much. Great.
I hope you don't think I'm stepping on your toes. After we talked at the bonfire, I realized I have some insight about our customers and what they seem to want.
No, I say. This is great. I mean, wow. It's so organized and clear. Ellie looks momentarily embarrassed, though her easy smile makes me think I imagined it.
What can I say? I was inspired.
I'm glad. It's great. Say great again, self. Seriously.
One last thing. I think for vacationers, it's unclear what kind of restaurant Tony's is. I know it's a big change, but I was thinking, what if we called it Tony's Bistro?
Huh, I consider this. Yeah, that sums it up. Casual but nice.
You think your dad would go for it?
she nods. I really do. I fold the paper and slide it into my back pocket. We pass the pottery shop, and I glance in to look for Vivi. Only Whitney is in there, and she waves to Ellie and me. I check my phone for texts, but there's nothing to find. It's not like her. So, Ellie says, how's your mom? I've only seen her at church once or twice since I got home from camp.
Oh, you know, fine.
Most people nod solemnly, relieved to have the awkward social obligation of asking out of the way. Ellie is quiet, so I glance over at her. She's narrowing her eyes. I can hardly see past her heavy eyelashes. Jonah, she slows her pace considerably, and I do too. How is your mom really? We both stop. We're standing on the sidewalk outside the park. I cross my arms. I open my mouth to say fine again, more convincingly this time. But saying it again seems like even more of a lie. Ellie's dark eyes study me, waiting. And I finally confess, not good at all. I start walking again, making a getaway from those four words. I broke the barrier between our family and the outside world, exposed us. Ellie catches up, right beside me. Like, how not good? Her whole face is soft. Being pitied makes me feel pitiful. Like, barely gets out of bed, okay? My voice sounds mean, even though I would never intentionally snap at her. Sorry, it's bad, it's... I don't know. I expect her to ask why the hell I haven't gotten my mom some help. I expect her to judge the entire way I've handled this situation as harshly as I judge myself for it. Instead, she whispers, I knew it. She whispers this to herself, like how you say damn it under your breath after you drop something. I'm so sorry, Jonah, Ellie says. Maybe it's none of my business. I've just had this feeling about it. God, don't apologize. I try to laugh, but it sounds bitter. Because I am. We've been trying to give my mom some time, Naomi and Silas and me.
But they go off to school at the end of August, and I can't take care of the three kids on my own.
Silas is talking about putting college off for a year. I don't want him to, but I don't know what else to do. We walk a few slow steps, and I'm conflicted. As relieved as I am to let all this out, I feel like I'm doing something behind my family's back.
Hey, you two,
Mrs. Albrecht calls from across the street as Edgar pauses to sniff at the fire hydrant. Ellie and I both wave, but my face burns. It's embarrassing, the way that someone walking in on you in the bathroom is embarrassing. Caught in a private moment. By the time we're out of earshot, Ellie and I are standing at the corner where we have to go different directions.
You do realize that, after everything with Diego, we know a lot about depression, medication, therapy, listening to one another and talking.
Her eyebrows are scrunched together, but I can't tell if she's confused or hurt, or both.
Why haven't you told my dad?
Because it's only been 7 months, because... In a weird way, it feels like her business, not mine. I don't want to embarrass her. There are a lot of reasons, I guess. She nods slowly.
Fair enough. What can I do?
Nothing. Just like that. I snap shut. It's an instinct.
After 7 months.
I mean, thanks, but we're fine. Now is the time to go our separate ways. But neither of us moves. Ellie's looking up at me, waiting. She's smoking me out with silence. If I go much longer without saying anything, it will become painfully awkward instead of just a little awkward. It'd be easy enough to stammer, okay, see you later, and walk away, but my mouth and legs won't cooperate. Actually, I say, before I even mean to, I keep chickening out of talking to your dad. I know my mom stopped doing the books for the restaurant after everything happened, but if your dad asked for her help again... I think she'd like that. Do you think you could suggest that? Ellie nods like it's totally normal to ask your friend to ask her dad if he can ask your mom for accounting help.
Of course. I'll bring it up with him subtly. Maybe that'll sort of open the door between my dad and your mom. And Jonah, please tell me if I can babysit or pick up some groceries, or I don't know what. Anything. I'd really like to help if I can. And if you ever need to talk, really. Thanks. We're actually doing pretty well most days. It's after Naomi and Silas leave that freaks me out. But Vivi keeps saying she might actually persuade